Good evening, Peter Eigen. I'm very happy to see you here. I'm happy that you honored our invitation in order to talk about corruption, an issue which has become particularly important. Peter Eigen is a journalist. He's from Augsburg. He studied law in Erlangen and Augsburg, and he worked for the World Bank for 25 years. He was also an advisor to the government of Botswana, and he also became the regional director for East Africa. Now, Peter Eigen has focused on corruption for 25 years. He has analyzed the situation. Now, he left the World Bank in 1993, and he founded an organization which you probably all know, that's Transparency International, a global organization to combat corruption. And he's also an initiator of an international initiative of countries and NGOs focusing on transparency in the payment procedures between the public and the private sector, another way to try and combat corruption. He's also a member of the board of the School of Governance in Berlin, and he's a lecturer at Berlin Free University. In 2007, he was a co-founder of the Berlin Society Center. And he wrote an important book about the network of corruption, which was published by Campus Verlag in German in 2003. Now, in the news yesterday, we heard that there is the new Corruption Perception Index of Transparency International. This was in the evening news of the public television in Germany, ARD, ZDF. Now, you have brought a copy, but can you tell us a bit more about the current corruption index and what the situation is? Well, thank you for having invited me. I'm very happy to be here. This is a wonderful building, and I'm happy to talk to you and with you. Unfortunately, I don't see your faces, so I don't know whether you are eager to hear more about corruption. I know that there are a number of people who don't want to talk about corruption at all. Now, the corruption index is actually an accidental product, so to speak. A number of years ago, in 1994, when we were a small group, just a bunch of people sitting in my kitchen talking about corruption, there was a young intern who worked with me, Graf Johann Lambsdorff, a count. And he said, well, we have to measure corruption. It's important to also map corruption in a quantitative way so that economists can deal with it. Now, I used to say, I don't have to measure corruption. I mean, if I see corruption, I know it's corruption, and I also know whether it's bad or not. So I was not really interested in his work, but he went on, he worked on his project, and he tried to figure out how to know more about corruption by means of polls. He wanted to know from business people, scholars, scientists, the media, and the civil society what they thought about the corruption of a particular country, and he made an index. And all of a sudden, we had 54 countries on a list, all at the reverse of an envelope, so to speak. And he showed it to me, and I said, well, that's quite nice, but I don't need it. But then he talked to a journalist of Der Spiegel. And in spite of the fact that the journalist promised to not publish the index, he published it just a week later, and we thought, well, okay, this is part of our work, and it's an important effort we undertake because we try to control corruption. Or should we rather go and say, okay, this is a young doctor-to-be, and we are not involved? But we decided to play along, and since then we have published the Corruption Index, the Corruption Perception Index, and it's published each year. Now, we've been publishing it for 15 years already, and believe me, lots of business people, lots of politicians, lots of scholars really look at what happens in the countries concerned, and they also observe the countries and they monitor them, so to speak. So they also try to find out whether the situation has improved or not and what these countries do in order to combat corruption. So I'd even say this has become one of the most important tools, or the most interesting tools we are using. However, it's not an analytic tool. This is not based on an analytic observation of the situation. This is not a study carried out by scholars or analysts who look at a number of countries. It's just a quantitative average of the results of observations or perceptions. Sometimes it's 14 institutions who run these polls for us. Sometimes it's only 10. But they always try to organize these studies. And when they do opinion polls, for example, or surveys, they include questions concerning the corruption perception. And this is, so to speak, the basis, or this was the basis of our Corruption Perception Index until last year. Until last year, we always had to say, no, these are surveys or polls made by others and, for example, included questions about the ranking of countries. So the most honest country would get 10 points and the least honest country would get 1 point only. But we also had experience value, so to speak. The Nordic countries did quite well after some time. In Germany, well, Germany always ranked among the first third of the countries concerned. Not particularly well with respect to other countries or in comparison to other countries, normally at position 14 or 15, whereas Sweden or Norway or Finland were on rank 1, 2 or 3. But then southern European countries, Italy, Spain, Greece followed, and then developing countries followed, in particular African countries like Nigeria, but also Bangladesh in Asia. Now, these were the countries at the bottom of the list. At the end, we had about 180 countries on our list. And this list has always been an important topic for me. And I often discussed about this list when I went to Mahathir, for example, in Malaysia, or Obasanjo, when I went to see Obasanjo in Nigeria, or Missionary from Ethiopia. He died recently. Now, they normally said, well, we don't approve of your methodology, and actually, you cause major damage to our countries. But actually, for them, it was an important signal or tool for them, too. And these countries also have an opportunity to watch whether their anti-corruption measures prove efficient or not. Now, last year, we changed our methodology because we found that we're dealing with a certain sequence of indexes over the years, i.e. it was getting a bit difficult to compare the situation because we never paid for the polls or the surveys, so we depended on the Economic Forum or other agencies who made their results available to us free of charge. So we have opted for a new system, and we've thus also changed the evaluation system. But it's still interesting to note that the ranking of the countries has not changed. And unfortunately, I have to say that the poorest countries are still the most corrupt countries, whereas the European countries or the further developed countries are ranking in much better positions. Now, has there been a change between the last indexes and the one you published yesterday? Well, yes. And no, we do see differences on some continents. Germany, for example, surprisingly enough, does rather well still, in spite of the fact that Germany has not agreed to signing the UN Convention Against International Corruption, which is an embarrassment, actually. It's embarrassing. I mean, imagine 160 countries in the world have signed and ratified the Anti-Corruption Convention of the United Nations, whereas the German parliament so far has not agreed to ratifying the convention, because we do have the interesting impunity of members of parliament in Germany. So you may well bribe MPs in Germany, but they enjoy impunity. They cannot be punished. Now, this is embarrassing, and it's a curiosity as well. You don't have it in any other country. But our MPs, our members of parliament, consider it extremely important, so they don't agree to ratify or sign a convention which is about to abolish this privilege. But, of course, we do have a lot of propaganda or PR, I'd rather call it, of Transparency International, and we try to really make people aware of this particular and very embarrassing situation. The BDI, an important association of entrepreneurs in Germany, have complained and told the government that they don't like the idea of being blamed in India or in Nigeria or in Russia by others for the German parliament not wanting to ratify the convention. So they do complain about the German parliament when meeting representatives of the German government. So there are changes underway. And we do see changes in the new index too. I mean, the general pattern has not changed much, unfortunately. And the countries that don't have much money anyway, where people live in poverty and in misery, are the most corrupt ones and have the most corrupt governments, and thus no chance of getting out of their poverty. Now, Mr. Eigen, the index was published yesterday, but I would like to ask you a fundamental question. What is corruption? How would you describe corruption? Transparency International says that corruption is if you abuse power for your private or personal benefit. Now, the question is it a private benefit in general? Can we say so? Is it for your personal benefit? I mean, what are the aspects Transparency International considers, first of all, when talking about corruption? Now, as I said, it's the abuse of power, and power you've been entrusted with, i.e. institutions or persons benefit from a position of power and try to have to gain personal benefits, private benefits, or have relatives or friends benefit from this position of power. I mean, this is not about morals. This is not about blaming others for general ethical reasons. We are very much in favor of implementing tools where people are affected by corruption, like national sections, which undertake our national offices, which undertake the analyses on the spot, in order to help the countries overcome corruption. And we always try to get as much information as possible in order to have a truly living definition. We have more than 160 national associations. We have thousands of members in Bangladesh and Argentina as well. We also have many members in Germany. There is an interesting section, actually, I'd even say in Germany, with more than 1,000 members, most of them are volunteers who act in a very professional way and who are very committed, very dedicated and active in many fields. So their duty, their task is, they have to monitor the situation. They watch out in order to find cases of corruption which cause damage to countries, to governments. And they normally collaborate with other forces, with NGOs, but also with business people in other countries in order to implement rules against corruption, for example. Now, whether it's petty corruption when parents, for example, have to pay money so that their children can go to school, first of all, or a nurse that claims money from a patient who's just leaving the OP theater if he wants to make sure that he will be healed, for example, or major corruption, a major German company, for example, that transfers millions to a Swiss bank account so that the elites, the decision makers in Africa and Asia, in Latin America, take the right decisions, i.e. the decisions he likes or the company likes. I mean, there are major differences. There are also different values. You have traditional societies where the gift plays a major role, or you also have a difference in terms of the support and extended family grants to the inhabitants of a certain village or the members of a certain tribe. And there you have different standards or standards that differ from our Prussian standards or values. But then, of course, the societies have to develop their own standards with respect to corruption. And we try to make the tools available so that they can diagnose the situation and do something about corruption, combat it. Well, that's interesting. You distinguish between petty and big corruption. I almost called it cooperation, but actually it's corruption, although corruption is also a form of cooperation, isn't it? Now, Transparency International is not only focusing on big corruption or the grand corruption in the relationship between countries and entrepreneurs, the two scandals, so to speak, but also on petty corruption. I mean, there is such a scandal I'm currently observing in Austria, my own country, and Austria is ranking very high in the Corruption Perception Index. Now, the question is, what do we do in view of the fact that there are gift economies, which could be labeled petty corruption, but then, on the other hand, you have lobbying or interest groups and millions that are spent in order to convince representatives of enterprises or politicians to do the right thing. Now, right you are, these are different worlds. When I started in 1990, I was the director of the office of the World Bank in Nairobi, and I found that the biggest projects, the most expensive ones, which were also about debt and guilt, and which were closely connected to the debts Nigeria, Kenya, and other countries had incurred, because of these projects, the countries had major debts. Nairobi, for example, well, there were, I was the chairman of a consultative group meeting, and there were the representatives of the United Nations and the regional banks and representatives of the business world of the country. And, of course, people talked about the question, what can be done in order to grant mutual support? And, of course, there was also jealousy and envy. And there were sometimes projects, if I were to give you an example, a huge power plant which was to be built somewhere and which would cost $600 or $700 million. And we knew that this would cause a major damage to the environment and we would have to resettle thousands of families. We knew that there were certain undercurrents and they would remain dry after a huge dam would be built and lots of nomads in the Bisamburo land or Turkana would eventually starve because normally they graze their cattle along these rivers and they stayed in the catchment basins even when the rivers were dry because these trees, the trees on the shores of the rivers had very long roots. Now, we knew that once the dam would be built, the river would dry out and the nomads and their cattle would not be would not survive, and they would go to Eldoret or Nairobi and they would live in the slums and they would be jobless. So we knew that this major project would cause major damage. It would not be a project the country would benefit from. And we also knew that the country had millions to be spent on schools and the health system, but the whole money would be spent on these huge projects. So we were the donor agency and we said we don't want these projects. However, these projects were implemented within a very short period. And you saw within weeks, the big bosses of German or French companies meeting the ministers or the president. You saw it on the front pages of the newspapers and you read, now this project is being implemented. The World Bank said no, but they don't understand what we need. However, these companies, these wonderful consortium of French or German or British entrepreneurs has managed to get the funds in order to finally implement the beautiful project we're talking about. Now, these projects were not only killing the current generation, but would be a major burden for upcoming generations. And I just heard the end of the last presentation. And indeed, these countries won't be able to pay back their debt. And these projects are promoted by an unholy alliance of suppliers from Germany, France, the UK, and Canada, people who know and who get the support from their countries. Now, they move to these countries, to Africa, for example, and they bribe the local decision makers. And this is not about 1 million or 5 million or 10 million on a Swiss bank account, but 50 or 80 or 100 million euros spent on projects which cost billions. Now, these are major projects. And these countries have triggered a lot of poverty and misery in the developing countries. And the developing countries today are still suffering from the impact of projects implemented 25 years ago. I mean, that's what I saw 25 years ago when I was the director of the World Bank office in Nairobi. And when I wanted to do something about it, I found that the World Bank representatives and also the countries concerned did not consider this a major case of corruption, and they did not allow the World Bank to do something against corruption systematically. And that's why eventually I had to leave my position. I had to resign. And I have realized since then that this is an unacceptable situation. I mean, actually, in Germany, it was lawful to bribe people in other countries. Until 1999, you could bribe politicians and other people in other countries, and you could even deduce the money spent from your tax duty. And when we said we want to abolish the system, we want to do away with it, people said, well, this is ridiculous. This is naive. That's the international market. There are no rules, so everybody has to find his own rules and do what needs to be done, i.e. bribe others, which is why the World Bank, which is sponsored by the taxation of rich countries, is not allowed to make life, the life of Siemens and other major companies, a bit more difficult. And I mean, this was my point of departure. I said, I'm very interested in the big corruption. I've sponsored projects for 25 years in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, many countries of the world. But I also know that there are projects people can benefit from. And I don't want to have this negative impact of corruption. I don't want to have these negative projects, which are a result of corruption. I don't want to see them all over the place. And then all of a sudden, in addition to the grand corruption, I was looking at, there was the petty corruption as well, when I wanted to introduce a system according to which the national sections of Transparency International should determine what is particularly damaging in their country. I've found that what is called little corruption or petty corruption is much more significant in countries like Africa or Asia. much more important than big corruption, whether President Arap Moi has 1 million more on his banking account or not, doesn't matter. But if a policeman who doesn't get paid well stops you on the street and you have to bribe him in order to move on, is a real problem for the citizens of the countries.
Die Richtlinien für die neue Organisation Transparency International auch auf die Petty-Korruption zu lenken. Obwohl das eine Riesenaufgabe ist, insbesondere wenn man bedenkt, wie schlecht bezahlt viele Beamte sind und deswegen die Petty-Korruption in vielen eigentlich diese Gesellschaften überhaupt erst im Gang hält.
Das ist eine wirklich sehr spannende Frage, weil sie natürlich auch nochmal thematisiert, wie die Zusammenarbeit in Transparency International organisiert wird. Wenn Sie mit diesen sehr vielen unterschiedlichen Situationen in den Ländern konfrontiert sind und daher auch mit sehr unterschiedlichen nationalen Beurteilungen von Korruption und Kampf gegen die Korruption, wie verbindet sich das dann transnational zu einer gemeinsamen Strategie in Transparency International oder wird darauf verzichtet?
Naja, also das ist inzwischen natürlich eine neue Situation eingetreten und ich meine, das haben wir zum Teil mit bewirkt. Nicht? Also am Anfang war ich höchst verhasst in Deutschland. Nicht? Das war ein absoluter Konsensus in der Regierung, wenn ich da auftauchte in Bonn damals und wollte im Wirtschaftsministerium oder so dafür plädieren, dass es doch im Interesse der deutschen Industrie ist, einen korruptionsfreien internationalen Markt zu schaffen, in dem die deutsche Industrie mit ihrer Tüchtigkeit, mit ihrer Qualität, mit den guten Preisen und so weiter sehr wettbewerbsfähig sein würde. Da hat man mich nur ausgelacht. Nicht? Und das war ähnlich in den Verbänden, das war ähnlich in der Wissenschaft. Ich kann mich erinnern, es gab ein Ethiker damals, ein Jesuitenpater, Rupert Ley heißt er, der hat Bücher geschrieben, hat gesagt, und ich kann mich erinnern an ein Interview, was er gegeben hat im Sonntagsblatt, hat er gesagt, ja, wenn man im Ausland Geschäfte machen will, da darf man nicht die eigenen Werte den anderen Leuten aufdrängen, sondern da muss man deshalb mitmachen, was so üblich ist, auch aus Respekt vor den anderen Kulturen. Er hat gesagt, ich war kürzlich in Indonesien, da wird es nicht nur geduldet die Korruption, und es wird sogar gepriesen als eine Aktivität, die die Wirtschaft in Gang bringt und hat praktisch den deutschen Unternehmern, die damals systematisch im Ausland bestochen haben, nicht alle, aber die meisten, hat er so eine Art Freibrief gegeben. Deswegen hat er seine Bücher über Wirtschaftsethik und so weiter damals sehr gut verkaufen können. Jedenfalls war er für mich ein sehr willkommener Feind. Sie sehen, dass er jetzt noch mein Feind ist, wenn ich solche Sachen sage. Ich konnte dagegen polemisieren. Ich habe dann sehr langsam, also gerade hier in Berlin haben wir im Aspen-Institut verschiedene Wirtschaftskapitäne um uns versammelt. Ich kann mich erinnern, die erste Sitzung hat Richard von Weizsäcker geleitet, der gerade sein Präsidentenamt beendet hatte. Und haben mit ungefähr 20 Wirtschaftskapitänen diskutiert darüber, was das denn ist, was sie da machen. Und die haben abgestritten, dass das Korruption ist. Die haben gesagt, das ist ganz normal, was wir da machen, das machen alle so. Und es ist einfach keine Korruption, wir dürfen da nicht unsere Maßstäbe anwenden. Und dann hatten wir ein zweites Meeting. Inzwischen war Siemens zum Beispiel aufgefallen, auf eine schwarze Liste gekommen in Singapur wegen Korruption. Und da merkten sie auf einmal, wie riskant es für sie ist, auch gegenüber ihren Kunden, und die ja auch nicht gerne ihre Geräte und so weiter kaufen wollten.
Who didn't want to purchase their goods and so on. So almost a year later, we'd never do that. I mean, we could even call this corruption, but there was a great deal of difficulty in doing business any other way on the international market. Then there was a third meeting. It's called collective action now. The island of integrity is what we called it back then. What we said was, we don't want you to stop this corruption from one day to the next, left, right, and center. What we want is that in certain competitive situations where you know your competitors, that you work together with us so that you all stop engaging in corrupt practices simultaneously. And I can remember the Siemens representative said, well, if you do that, then I'll take part too, because we really do believe that we could be competitive in a corruption-free market. We worked together very closely with Siemens. They became cooperative members of the German chapter. And that brought us the idea of collective action. We subsequently adopted a convention under the aegis of the OECD that was signed in 1997, and all of the signatory states committed to putting an end to corruption. It entered into force in 1999. In May 1999, corruption was prohibited in Germany. That was bribes abroad. It was no longer tax deductible. That was really scandalous. So that was ended in 1999, but it's not really properly implemented yet. Japan, for example, is a signatory state, but they don't implement it. Great Britain, 2-3 years ago, did try to deal with cases of corruption, but they actually prohibited cases of corruption in Saudi Arabia for their armaments firms. And in Germany, there's now 120 legal proceedings, not just against Siemens, Bilfinger Berger, and so on and so forth. All of these large firms who are active internationally. So I was subject to a great deal of attacks and criticism from other NGOs for working with Siemens, because they said, oh, they just want to have you as a kind of fig leaf, a kind of alibi, they'll never change. I said, well, you know, I believe them, as a matter of fact. So I said, well, I'm going to take their promise that they want to change, and I'm going to take it as read and believe them and work on that basis. An open letter was signed by these captains of industry to the Kohl government, to Minister Rexroth, and it called upon the government to participate in this OECD convention. If that letter had not been written, then Germany would never have participated in the OECD convention, which means the French wouldn't have been on board either. The Brits only signed up very hesitantly, and the Japanese are still not implementing it. And that was really the threshold. We stepped across that line. Since then, the UN's been on our side entirely. Same goes for the World Bank with Wolfensohn. The World Bank is probably the most important anti-corruption organization in the world nowadays. There's been a complete change in the situation, and our work's become a great deal more straightforward now. Well, that brings me on to a very important point relating as well to the lecture we just heard from Mr. Lazzarato. What is the significance of corruption in this topical pressing crisis? How does the debt crisis hang together with these kind of phenomena of corruption? Well, if you think of Europe, in Greece's the most corrupt country in Europe. It was held to be the most corrupt country in Europe. And in Greece, there were a great deal of people who wanted to work with us, who wanted to combat the corruption of their ruling elite. But Greece is an example as well of the fact that responsibility for corruption in Greece or in other corrupt countries lies not just with the ruling elite there, it's also systematically and systemically the responsibility of banks and of business people from Germany as well, who handed out bribes, for example, to get contracts. All kinds of people lined their pockets because of those erroneous decisions which were taken in the past and which the man in the street in Greece is now having to pay for. I think it's very important that we realize that we have a shared responsibility. We have shared guilt. To come back to the topic of this evening, we are all guilty for these debts having come into being. Almost one third of the debt in developing countries can be seen to be derived from corruption, that the wrong kind of projects were proposed, which nobody would have funded Otherwise, I can cite examples all around the world. And this is something which large firms have done systematically in conjunction with donor organizations, with embassies. They promoted this kind of approach. Projects came into being that nobody needs. In Nigeria, there's projects that cost billions, and they didn't work for one single minute. The only people who benefited from them were the people who supplied goods or services or the banks who were involved in the financing, plus the kleptocrats. They got billions that they transferred from Nigeria to London or Zurich or wherever they have their secret bank accounts and conceal their wealth. It's very hard to do anything to combat this, but there is a clear connection between the high debt levels in the third world, the difficulties that they're encountering, and our guilt in the West or in the North, because we have systematically gone to these countries and bought up their elites. We sold them things that we knew would not do them any good, that were not just detrimental for the economy, for future generations who have to pay the debts in as much as they have to pay at all. Perhaps they'll be shouldered by the taxpayers in Germany or in the West in general, because the banks may get a bailout on that front too. But it's not just that kind of problem. There's also environmental damage, social distortions, and the genuine priorities are neglected. That means that now in the world there's 1 billion people living under the poverty threshold and almost 2 billion people in the world who have no access to clean water and proper treatment of wastewater and sewage. Access to drinking water has improved somewhat. There's perhaps 9 million people who currently have no access to clean drinking water. As a consequence, women and children die of all kinds of diseases. Almost 10 million children die every year before they're 5 years old. Horrendous figures of child mortality, which are simply not acceptable. Not to mention the kind of crisis which arises in the east of Congo, for example, and all around the globe. Corruption, conflict, violence, expulsions all arise together. Corruption, to my mind, is still the prime reason why so many developments have been destroyed in so many countries. And I'm delighted that the message has started to get across and that it's seen clearly in so many institutions. One of the results of corruption is excess debt, over-indebtedness. I was involved in this too when I was head of division for Latin America. That was a time when we had the first oil boom, 76, when the price shot up from $6 to $12 or so. All of the oil producing countries in the Arab world deposited their cash in New York and London. The banks didn't know what to do with their money, so we were called upon as the World Bank to do something to help these poor countries who are also suffering from the increase in oil prices and to assist them with take up of capital as rapidly as possible. In Latin America, for example, we give rise to this enormous levels of excess debt. And looking back, I would say this was institutional corruption of the World Bank, because we didn't act in the interests of the recipient countries. We were driven by rich countries who had the majority of the votes on the board of the World Bank. So these excessive levels of debt are very closely linked with corruption. I think what you're saying is very important, and also this shift in perspective. The moral gaze always relates to those who are corrupted, not to those who are doing the corrupting, who are handing out the bribes. Although, of course, promising strategies to combat this should actually attack those who are handing out the bribes, not those who are said to be corruptible. I must admit that in Transparency International, we try not to foreground these ethical issues. It's a multicultural international organization. We've got national sections in Muslim countries, in Catholic countries, in Protestant countries, in Buddhist countries. We didn't want our organization to be seen as, I don't know, Rome, the World Bank, but some central body stipulating and determining values. And of course, particularly if you think of Berlin as imposing these values, that's perhaps not the source of all salvation. So corruption is something which destroys democracy. It's fatal to democracy. If you want economic growth, corruption is catastrophic. Corruption aims at buying the wrong decisions. If you take this rather technocratic approach that we did, we were fairly successful with that. The national sections reached out to their religious communities on the basis of their cultural values. Hans Kung sent me a letter once telling me about what was being done. He said, oh, it's all on paper. It's just theoretical. It's not practical either. 5 billion people in the world are supposed to work together. You need instead to look at questions of ethics, guilt, good and evil, not just utility, what's helpful, what's damaging. I once organized an entire conference in Korea. It was about 8 years ago. I looked at various different value sets, distinct ethical systems, and how they all relate to corruption. Hans Kung was invited, and various other religious leaders and thinkers, but we didn't really come up with any clear result as to what we ought to do to get the ethical arguments integrated into our international organization without creating the impression that we're trying to engage in value imperialism from Berlin. And of course, Transparency International is organized in a fairly democratic way. Our board, our secretariat is based in Berlin. We've got 180 staff by now from all over the world. They work under the control of a board of 12 people. They come primarily from the third world. They're elected by the national sections and a few other members, and that means that we respond to a high degree to the wishes of our national sections. We need to get the right measure when it comes to ethical elements. The question of guilt has to be mixed properly with technocratic consideration. We haven't yet struck the right balance. That's partly why I find it so fascinating to be able to come along this evening. Well, thank you very much for being with us this evening. Now, if anybody in the audience has questions, do please feel free to put these questions now. We'd discuss this beforehand, so there's scope to put questions. Unfortunately, because it's dark at the moment, we can't see MD in the room. So if you do want to ask a question, perhaps we could turn the lights up a bit. Might that be an idea? We believe in transparency, after all, in Transparency International.
Yeah. Das ist doch ganz erheblich viel.
Well, that was a good idea. And we've got people with microphones as well, roaming mics. If any of you would like to put a question, please do remember to speak into a microphone so that you can be interpreted. The same goes for comments as well. Mr. Herdisch. I've been told by people who work in industry as well that a pragmatic approach is often, not to call it corruption, but to have contracts with advisors. Say you're exporting to Saudi Arabia, some princes need to be taken care of, so to speak, and they're given a job. They used to just be paid a bribe, and now Siemens has a consultant's contract with them. Does that tally with your information? Is that the pragmatic approach to avoid this unpleasant term, corruption? And how do you appraise this when it's based, set up in this formal way? Well, in contrast to Amnesty International, we don't address individual cases of corruption and condemn them. If they're in the public domain, then we address them. But you're quite right. There are borderline cases, particularly in highly patriarchal societies. In the Arab world, for example, it's almost viewed as a kind of tax. If it's a regular payment which is made, this must be done publicly. And if it's quite done publicly and is clear to everybody, in the sense it is a kind of tax, and we wouldn't intervene. I don't know if you know the Alabama case. That's a case in which British Aerospace paid £100 million to the son of the Minister of Defense of Saudi Arabia for 10 years. So it ended up being $1 billion that was paid at the end of the day. And a Boeing was equipped just as he wished. And that became clear at a point in time when foreign corruption was banned abroad. And so the Serious Fraud Office started to look into this matter. First of all, British Aerospace was going to get into trouble. And the same went for the representatives of the government of Saudi Arabia. They were to be made accountable. The Blair government stepped in. Their attorney general prohibited the Serious Fraud Office from investigating any further. We entered an appeal against this ruling. Transparency International has a very good chapter in London, and a number of other NGOs were involved too. And at appeal, the ruling went in our favor. It's very interesting to read the substantiation of the judgment. It was a great judge who spelled everything out very clearly and made clear how the message should be handed across, conveyed to the general public. And then a further appeal was lodged by the government. And the final conclusion was that the Serious Fraud Office was not allowed to continue investigating this because it might affect the defence and security interests of the UK if Saudi Arabia were unhappy with the outcome. Because, of course, we cooperate on anti-terrorism and so on and so forth. So there's various different ways to resolve problems. As a test, as a litmus test, I would say that if it's possible to publish these payments, if, for example, it can appear in the annual report of Siemens, we paid $10 million to Mr. XYZ and he wants to, for example, build hospitals with it, generally that kind of reason is cited, then it's not possible to do anything against it, but perhaps one should not. But if there's a secret payment to make the wrong decision, then there's no society in the world that would justify that. We leave it up to our sections to determine which is relevant in their own country. We're sometimes a bit disappointed. The Italian chapter was always pretty pro-Berlusconi, but in our global international publications, we were very critical of him. So there was a kind of tension there. They said you shouldn't talk down to us and tell us what's wrong with our society. It was a real problem with Italy. But the national chapters or the national sections are very have a great deal of room for maneuver, and they can determine what is the case in their country. Now, the UK has at long last introduced reasonable legislation prohibiting corruption in business transactions abroad. This is one of the last things which Tony Blair did with the Labour government. International business is very worried about this. There's the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the US, which is very stringent. Same goes for Germany and London now as well. And all of a sudden, businesses are starting to take this very seriously. Yesterday, I read that the pharmaceutical industry in America has started to keep lists about any gifts of over more than $10. So Pfizer, for example, has given gifts to doctors. I mean, we're far from this in Germany, unfortunately, but in Germany, people are giving thought to these issues. So a number of firms are keen to have clear rules and to ensure that these rules are actually implemented with expensive compliance provisions. The only ones who are really lagging behind are the people in our Bundestag. There are certain parliamentary groups that do support the idea of ratification of the UN Convention, the Greens, Social Democrats, Die Linke, they all supported this. And there's some amongst the Christian Democrats who are also in favor. Mr. Lammers, for example, raised the issue. But there are some who think that their lifetime mission is to promote the impunity of parliamentarians so that they don't end up with halfway in prison if they've been doing illegal things with their internet and so on and so forth. I don't know if I actually heard all of your question, but I think that I have responded as much as I can. Question of Mike, you need to speak into a microphone. What year is this act from the one on for the protection of MPs in the Bundestag? And what about Austria? Where's Austria in the ranking? Well, I can tell you that straight off the head. It's off the top of my head. It's 25th. Some states complain that they're evaluated too positively. Some complain that they're evaluated too negatively, in Austria in particular. There's a great deal of public interest in sorting out all of these cases of corruption. We've got 176 states, and they felt that ranking 25th. Well, actually, that's too honourable for Austria. Well, yes, I'd agree with that. Did I answer all of your questions? No, yes, there was also the question as to the date when this act was promulgated, the German one. Well, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the US is from 77. It was after Watergate. Jimmy Carter initiated that. And since then, American firms are not allowed to bribe abroad. There's a bribe payers index which measures the propensity of business people to hand out bribes in international business. But actually, US businessmen use alternative instruments which make them look much more corrupt than, for example, the Germans and the French. The Americans thought that because of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, they were top of the league table and were the best. The German amendment is from May 1999. That's exactly when the OECD convention entered into force. The UN Convention Against Corruption dates from 2002. It was signed by Germany then as well, and there's now 160 states which have ratified it. And of the richer states, the OECD states, there's only Japan and Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is not OECD, but it's a rich state. And Germany, they're the only ones that haven't ratified so far. And I think that's really a scandal. It's outrageous. I've discussed this with important figures. I've discussed this twice with Angela Merkel, and the government took the stance that this initiative for ratification must come from the ranks of the parliament because MPs are affected by corruption. But this initiative didn't come as a kind of groundswell from amongst the parliamentarians, and that means something very important. If you think back, in Wuppertal, there was a major corruption case. There was a building contractor who'd bribed a member of the town council, and both were charged. But after a final appeal, this ruling was overturned because the member of the town council is a parliamentarian and cannot therefore not be convicted due to impunity provisions for ordinary corruption. Most people don't know this, but it's really rather an embarrassing detail. Well, it's not what year did this immunity law come from? Well, immunity is something that all parliamentarians have. That protects them against being punished whilst in office. But it's impunity that we're talking about, and it comes from the 1950s. Paragraph 108A in the criminal code, saying that it's only a purchase of votes that is punishable. Please speak into the microphone. You've described your organization. You've said that you contact firms to counteract corruption by introducing new provisions on corruption. So you described how it functions and that there are new behavioral standards that you introduce in companies to avoid corruption and combat corruption. I'm wondering about this because those who profit from corruption, well, there's the firms involved and the people in the countries in question who benefit. Is it often the case that there isn't a legal basis in those countries to really make the people who benefit from these bribes in the countries in question accountable? And does Transparency International also address that, also give some thought to creating this kind of legal basis in those countries? I mean, the idea is more democratic structures, which in some cases simply aren't present. So I wonder what you do with these people who benefit from the bribes on the spot. Well, that's a good question. I have to admit that acoustically it's hard to hear everything that's coming out of the audience. But I think I grasped your point. Before 1999, foreign corruption abroad, was not punishable. Because what we're looking at protecting, according to German law, was the integrity of the German official. If you bribed an official abroad, that was an issue for the legislation of the other country. But the problem was, if you bribed somebody abroad, the figures that you were bribing often had so much power that a judge wouldn't be bold enough to do anything against them. So German business people said, well, if they don't want us to do this, then they just need to forbid it. President Moi, for example, was so powerful. In Kenya, you can imagine that no judge would ever dare to act against this when he lined his pocket with corruption money, with bribes from, for example, Siemens. The World Bank took much the same stance. They said that corruption is a domestic political issue for our partner countries, and therefore, as per our statutes, the World Bank isn't allowed to intervene. For example, if in a World Bank project there's corruption and there's distortion of the call for tenders and the contract is awarded to a particular beneficiary for large projects funded by the World Bank, then we could say we're not going to fund it. Because economically it would be an erroneous investment, but it wouldn't be because it was corruption. And this attitude is one that the World Bank defended for a very long time. They said we can only introduce penalties for corruption if this is condemned and charges are brought in the other jurisdiction under their jurisdiction. In Lesotho, there was a case. Lammeyer, a German firm, was punished for corruption by the local judges to the tune of several millions. And they said, well, they don't get the plot. But then they were on the black list of the World Bank. At long last, we didn't manage to introduce these penalties in the World Bank. It was an enormous struggle. So that if somebody had been caught involved in corruption, then they would be on a black list and would no longer be able to submit a bid for a World bank project. Lamire was on that black list for years and years, and they nearly went bankrupt because of it. So the question of judicial condemnation of corruption is something that's very problematic when you think about cooperation with these fragile countries, Latin America, Africa, for example. Within Germany, corruption was always prohibited. It was tax deductible. So you could enter in your tax declaration because it said that tax law is value neutral. So you could say that a bribe was tax deductible as part of your business acquisition expenses, but you had to tell us who you had bribed so that it was quite clear who had to pay tax on the bribe. But then, of course, it was also possible to pay the tax already on behalf of the person who was bribed so that no tax fell due. And the tax office in Munich, for example, took the following view. Prostitutes have to pay tax on their income, and that means that tax law is value-free. And therefore, you would have to pay taxes irrespective.
Steuer, die Korruption immer strafbar.
But of course, corruption is always punishable, with the notorious exception of the members of parliament. And I'm really happy to be here and tell you all this so that you get angry, because it's incredible. I mean, in particular, if you are involved with lobby activities, and of course, lobbyists do a good job and what they do is important, but when things are sensitive or when projects are sensitive, you have to clearly know the rules. And you have to have clear rules. And there are lots of MPs who agree to what we think, but the majority of the members of parliament still object. Now, the German chapter is, of course, the Transparency International Agency in charge of combating corruption in Germany, and of course they are focusing on interest conflicts and blacklists when it comes to tenders in Germany, in the regions or on a national scale. So the German chapter is rather active and is doing a good job, but there are differences between the countries, of course. Well, we are slowly but gradually moving forward as far as the corruption perception in Germany is concerned. We are at position number 14. Now, I am being told that we have to wind up, because the opening of the exhibition you see downstairs in the lobby is on our agenda now. So I would like to thank you for being here with us, Mr. Eigen, and of course we don't want to end the discussion. Neither was you, neither was Mr. Lazzarato. There will be an opportunity.